This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. Trump versus social media. That is what we're going to be talking about today. Because last Thursday, United States President Donald Trump signed an executive order targeting social media companies. Trump said he made the move in the name of protecting freedom of speech. But does this make sense, or does Trump have a warped understanding of the First Amendment of the US Constitution? So to take a deep dive into the topic with me, I have on Zoom Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, who is a retired lawyer and academic whose area of expertise include political psychology, media, and global political economy. Hello, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dashran. Nice to be here.
Let's get right into it. Can you break down the sequence of events that led to Trump signing the executive order?
Sure. So about 2 weeks ago or so, I don't know if your listeners are aware of these different media personalities in the U.S. They're not really worth your time. I wouldn't really look into them very much. But there's a TV show on MSNBC, I think it is, with Mika Brzezinski, the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former national security advisor to Carter, and her husband, Joe Scarborough. And apparently they said, you know, they've been enemies of Trump for a while now after initially being friendly with him. But anyway, they said something, or rather Joe said something that particularly annoyed Trump one day. And so Trump then tweeted out something about a woman that worked in Scarborough's former congressional office who died in his office, hit her head on a desk. And the autopsy report said that she had, I think, some sort of a medical condition that may have made her pass out. And then, you know, she hit her head. Anyway, Trump tweeted something that insinuated that perhaps Joe Scarborough had actually murdered this woman. And he, you know, tweeted out something incendiary, trying to get people to think that maybe Joe Scarborough is a murderer and let's get to the bottom of this. So Mika Brzezinski then contacts Jack Dempsey, I think his name is, the CEO of Twitter. And then she announces that she's succeeded at arranging a meeting with him where she's going to finally talk about Twitter's policy on Donald Trump's misleading or lie-filled tweets. Anyway, a few days later, Trump tweets something out about the possibility of voter fraud in mail-in ballots. So because of the COVID crisis in the U.S., a lot of people are talking about shifting the election to a mail-in ballot election. And so Trump said something about, you know, fraud is rife in mail-in ballots and California is going to send out ballots to everyone, even if they aren't registered voters. You know, typical Trump tweet that, to be kind, somewhat disconnected from reality. Mm. And then what Twitter did, and this is after the meeting with Brzezinski, was they would put up a little notice before you read Trump's tweet, or perhaps attached to it, basically saying that this tweet may have misleading information. Please click here if you want to, you know, see a fact check of this tweet, something of that nature. And that happened to a couple of his tweets. And then, so that of course angered him immensely. So he then signs this executive order. So that, just to answer your question, that's the kind of backstory to where we are today.
Yes. Okay. So when you say, you know, they put this sort of label over a couple of his tweets, even after signing the executive order, Trump went on to tweet, you know, about the George Floyd murder. Let's just call it what it is. And basically what Trump did was encourage the military to use violence to contain protests. And I quote, he says, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." So this was, you know, especially frustrating, I think, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Trump is an expert at using Twitter to inflame his opponents and to get his supporters more engaged as well. So this is just typical Trump.
Okay. But despite that, so let's just, you know, make a couple of things clear. Twitter didn't ban Trump from the social media platform, did they?
Correct.
Okay. Correct. They didn't even remove his posts, which is technically within their rights to do so.
No, they did not. As far as I'm aware, they simply put this little notice on top or alongside of his tweet so that people receiving the tweet would be able to, you know, do an extra click and see a fact check of the tweet.
Okay. So this was enough to infuriate Trump to the degree that he, you know, he went on to sign an executive order, which basically targets social media companies. And it's not just Twitter. We're talking about Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and a couple of others. What exactly is Trump's executive order all about? Can you break it down for us?
Yeah, I mean, first thing to keep in mind is that this is really a kind of a tempest in a teacup. This executive order is unlikely to really do anything. I think that the real motivation is really just to try to intimidate Twitter against doing the kind of, you know, fact check screen on his tweets or what have you. But ostensibly, what the executive order does is to direct the Attorney General to discuss and think about and propose a potential interpretation of an old law, and perhaps change the interpretation of the law. And specifically, it focuses on this particular section of the Communications Decency Act, which does two things. One, it shields social media companies from lawsuits by, you know, private individuals or corporations who feel that, you know, they have been, say, defamed by someone online.
Hmm.
So the law as it currently exists basically says, no, you cannot sue the social media company. You can always sue the person. So if you, Dashran, you know, went on Twitter and said, Peter Beattie is a mass murderer, I could then sue you for defaming me, but I couldn't sue Twitter for assisting you in your defamation.
Right.
The other thing that this section of the law does is it says that if you post something on one of these social media platforms and the company decides to censor your post for whatever reason, basically if they think it's objectionable in some way, likewise you can't sue them for censorship or for some other reason. So ostensibly what this executive order would do is to get the Attorney General to think about ways that the law could be interpreted differently or perhaps even changed in its application so that people would be able to sue a social media company like Twitter over content that is posted on Twitter.
Okay. Okay. But earlier you brought up something very interesting, and that is you said this order is unlike to actually do anything. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's, you know, legal experts who have looked at this think that there's a number of problems with it. One that the regulatory agency mentioned in the order, the Federal Communications Commission or FCC, doesn't really have the power to do what Trump is asking them to consider doing. Another issue is that such an order would be ruled unconstitutional in the courts in any case. So even if they were able to, you know, get the FCC to change the way that it interprets this rule and extends its power to be able to change the interpretation of the law, that nonetheless, even if they were able to do that, courts would strike down any attempt by someone to go to court and include Twitter or include Facebook as a defendant because some third party defamed them or committed some other offense against them.
All right. Okay. So unconstitutional. That's an interesting thing you brought up, because that, along with free speech, is what we're going to be talking about a little later, but right now we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, Peter and I are going to be talking about the impact of Trump's executive order towards free speech. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back once again to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Dashran Johan, and zooming in all the way from Hong Kong to discuss the impact of Trump's executive order targeting social media companies on free speech is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, who is a retired lawyer and academic in the field of political psychology, media, and global political economy. So before the break, we broke down the sequences of events that led to Trump signing this executive order targeting social media companies. Why do you think Trump is doing this?
Well, I think it's really just an attempt at intimidating Twitter or coercing Twitter into rolling back its recent policy of, you know, putting little disclaimers on some of Trump's tweets. I really think that that's all it is at the end of the day. And the funny thing is that even if all of the legal problems with this sort of a move were superseded and overcome, and Trump was actually able to remove these sorts of lawsuit protections from social media companies, the resulting situation would be that he would probably have even less free speech, because he would have all sorts of people suing Twitter over things that he himself says, giving Twitter all the more reason to really censor him.
That is definitely something we have to, you know, look into in detail. We'll discuss that shortly. But, you know, so that is what we are saying. Okay, that's what a lot of the media are saying. That's what a lot of critics are saying. But what Trump himself is saying is that social media platforms shouldn't have the power to decide what is fake news and what isn't, as that violates freedom of speech. So we want to explore this a little bit. But first, what exactly is free speech in terms of the First Amendment and the American Constitution?
Well, the sort of summary of what free speech means in the U.S., I think, was best stated by Judge Learned Hand in a decision, I think, around 1920 or so. He basically said that the best proof of truth is the ability of an idea to compete within a free marketplace of ideas and emerge victorious. And then he goes on to say that to some, this will be folly. This is foolish. But we have staked upon it our all. So in other words, there are other approaches to free speech. Some people would say this is an idiotic idea. You can have all sorts of garbage ideas spreading and fake news and falsehoods and whatnot. And there's no good reason to expect that only good ideas or true ideas would actually win in an open sort of battle of ideas. But nonetheless, that is what the entire U.S. system, at least when it comes to issues of free speech, that's what the whole system is based on.
Okay, so I just want to give you an example just to put things into perspective. So we are in the U.S., we are walking, I don't know, in Times Square, for example. So I take a microphone, I take a loudhailer, and I start spewing fake facts about certain races, for example. Oh, the African American community is so and so and so, all fake. Is that legal or illegal?
That's entirely legal.
Okay.
That's where the U.S. system looks much more liberal than even other Western countries. Like in Germany, for instance, you've got laws against hate speech. In the U.S., it's the standard now is the only time speech can be criminalized, it's speech that imminently incites towards lawless behavior. So if you're just saying a bunch of lies about particular groups in the U.S., but you're not getting people to imminently attack them, for instance, then your speech is protected.
So for the next part of our discussion, I think we have to keep in mind whatever we just talked about right now, a few seconds ago, right? Because doesn't that mean that Donald Trump to a certain extent, has a point. And what I mean by that is, of course, from if you look at it through an unbiased sort of critical lens or whatever, you know that perhaps Donald Trump is saying what he's saying or doing this executive order for maybe selfish reasons, right? But who in Twitter makes the decision of what's fake news and what's not?
Excellent question. And I agree that in that executive order itself, there's a lot of sensible language in there. And I refer specifically to the idea that these massive tech companies like Facebook and Twitter, they provide a kind of public service, internet-based public sphere for discussion, but they're still private. This kind of tension between the profit-making orientation of a corporation in the U.S. and then the public good, on the other hand, which is to have a free public sphere for political issues to be debated. But of course, I think the more thoughtful people who have similar concerns about this, they're not arguing for the approach of allowing people to sneeze for defamation or what have you. They're looking at it in a much more realistic sense of, we need to either break up these companies, and there's many ways you could do that. You could follow the Bell model of just splitting up this massive monopoly into smaller competing companies. But even then, it's very difficult when you're dealing with these social media platforms, which have these interesting kind of economies of scale, where a huge part of the benefits that each individual user gets is the fact that there are hundreds of millions of other people on that same platform. So simply splitting it up into smaller entities, it's hard to see how that would really work. Another way of doing it would be basically to allow the underlying data, people's posts, people's friends lists, et cetera, to be basically open source, where anybody can create a Facebook or a Twitter where all of the same information, all of the same tweets, all the same posts can be used by this alternative platform. But of course, that would be absolutely fatal to the business model of Twitter and Facebook. So really, it seems like the best solution would be some sort of nationalization, making these private companies democratically controlled to provide a public service. But of course, that's not what Trump's executive order is about.
Right. And I guess to circle around the topic a little bit more, if you look at it from a free speech perspective, is there an argument to be made that a lot of the rage that we are seeing towards Trump's executive order comes from the perspective of, people who are liberal? We are judging it based on Donald Trump's character, based on his past behavior on social media. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, what exactly is social media? Because again, we're looking at it in context of free speech in the US. So if social media is kind of like our world right now, except brought onto an online sphere, it's a public forum where people from everywhere can talk to each other and post their opinions. If I can go to Times Square and say what I want, shouldn't I be able to say what I want on Twitter? Is there a way of looking at it from that perspective?
Yeah, definitely. And what you said at the beginning here is I think very true. There's a phenomenon called Trump derangement syndrome, where the idea is that Trump is just such an outrageous personality that he's made people on the liberal side of the U.S. political spectrum lose their minds to some extent, and they only see things through a Trump prism. But I think actually we can go a little even further back to get at what's really going on here. And I would say, imagine if you're looking into how the U.S. media system works around 2000, end of last century, beginning of this. What you would see is a media system that really functions much like a propaganda system, but it's amazing because there's no top-down control guaranteeing and enforcing a sort of ideological uniformity within the system overall. So there's a lot of reasons for that, and lots of scholars have written about that, myself included, so I'll just leave that aside. But basically at that time, if you were a critic of U.S. foreign policy, for instance, you would have very little hope for the U.S. because you would realize that what's going on here is that the vast majority of people have no idea what their government is doing around the world. And to the extent that they have any idea whatsoever, it's a very blinkered perspective where they just think that all of these interventions around the world are motivated by democracy and human rights and whatnot and are fundamentally good. So if you're, you know, in nearby Indonesia and you're wondering how could a democratic country support the mass murder of a million people in 1965 here in my country, wouldn't, you know, there be some sort of moral outrage? And of course, if you study the US media system, you would say, oh no, I understand why there was no moral outrage. No one knew anything about it. And the few people who knew a little bit about it viewed it as a good thing because they were fighting the evil communists, you know? So around 2000, you would have thought, well, there's really no hope for the U.S. because its people are simply kept ignorant of opposing perspectives on foreign policy, but also any other issue. Now, fast forward a couple of decades, and you see how revolutionary the internet has been, because the internet provides a far greater diversity of ideological perspectives than the legacy media system of newspapers and TV stations and radio stations. So people now in the US are getting, and this isn't a majority, non kind of standard center-right liberalism from the Democratic Party or non-standard conservatism in the Republican Party is still relatively rare, but it's much, much, these ideas are much more accessible today because of the internet than they were even 20 years ago. Mm. So what this was a really key factor in Donald Trump's winning the nomination, the Republican nomination. It was a huge factor in Bernie Sanders' unexpected success and almost victory to get the Democratic nomination. It was a factor in getting Donald Trump elected. And so you have to understand within the U.S., people in the sort of political establishment, people working in D.C., people working in the legacy media in New York, it was an incredible shock for them that someone as outrageous and beyond the pale as Donald Trump could possibly win the presidency. Mm. So his win set off all of these concerns. You know, you had this moral panic over potential Russian meddling that didn't really amount to much. I mean, the evidence in media research is very clear that Russian meddling efforts were minor compared to the very enormous and very influential right-wing media ecosystem in Trump's election. Nonetheless, it set off this series of fears about the internet and fake news. So that got people thinking, you know, what are we going to do about this? How do we return to the days when the legacy media effectively controlled the permissible boundaries of political thought and debate in this country? Because now that seems to have been blown open. So a lot of different ideas were put forth. Facebook would have a fact checker where they would get people from various institutions, the Atlantic Council, which is linked to NATO. Then also the Israeli government has been used to police posts about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So you can already see some danger here in the kinds of fact-checking endeavors that were initially suggested and were initially implemented.
Right.
You know, if you're going to have people who are basically just supportive of traditional U.S. foreign policy determining what is fake news and what isn't, and then being able to soft censor things that they don't like by either, you know, eliminating them from people's news feeds, making them less likely for the algorithm to pick them up and show them to people. That, I think, is the much broader concern, the much deeper concern is that we may have a social media environment or an internet environment where ideas that go against the political establishment are kind of soft censored away. There's no overt censorship, or perhaps there might be, but you don't really need that. There's this concept called the search engine manipulation effect. Researchers found that all they would need to do is change the order in which Google searches pop up. So let's say you search just for Donald Trump. If you made the first 10 articles all positive towards Trump, that has a very powerful effect on public opinion. They estimated that it could move elections by as much, I think, as 10%. So that can entirely swing an election. So that's the real concern here. You don't need to have hard censorship where someone gets sent to jail for posting something that the censors don't like. All you really need is to have your algorithm on Facebook or Twitter give less attention to ideas that are viewed as unacceptable or wrong by the political establishment. So that's, I think, the broader context of this particular little kerfluffle, which I don't think really will amount to much of anything, but it is a useful entry point into this much more important, much broader discussion.
Yes, because I think that's what this is essentially all about, right? Whether or not Trump's executive order actually amounts to something, you know, very impactful or not, I think what's more interesting are the conversations that are happening because of it. So as silly as this is going to sound, is social media the streets of Times Square, or is it a fine dining restaurant? And what I mean by that is restaurants can have their own rules of who they want to admit or not. A restaurant can say, I only want a person who is dressed a particular way to be allowed to enter. If you're dressed in slippers and shorts, you're not allowed to enter. They are allowed to set their own parameters. Whereas if I'm just walking around Times Square, I can, you know, just dress up however I want. How are we supposed to look at Twitter, for example? Is Twitter supposed to be this open forum where anybody can say anything, or is it supposed to be this sort of closed thing where Twitter can decide what they deem acceptable to post?
Well, I guess when it comes to what is it supposed to be, it really gets down to who is doing the supposing. So from the company's perspective, all of this is kind of irrelevant. The speech that's going on makes no difference to them. All they care about is keeping eyeballs on the app, clicking through, interacting so that they can get a higher price for advertising. So that's right. How they view it. That's what it's supposed to do, is make money for them. But from a societal perspective, what it's supposed to be is a expansion of the public sphere. The concept of the public sphere originates with coffee shops and salons in Europe in the 1700s, where people get together, drink coffee, read newspapers, and discuss politics. And out of this burgeoning public sphere comes the idea that democracy would actually work, because, you know, you can go to the coffee shop, you meet a bunch of strangers, they all have political ideas, they can all debate. So yeah, it looks like actually the common person, or rather, you know, the more privileged people in that society should be able to govern themselves. Then the public sphere evolves and changes over time, so that when you have mass newspapers emerging in the late 1800s, that changes the kind of media ecosystem of newspapers. You get fewer partisan papers, and instead the code of journalistic professionalism, the kind of both sides idea of objective journalism, that changes the public sphere. And then, of course, with radio and TV, it changes even further. But in all of these instances, it's a very one-way street. You have these incredibly powerful means of communication, newspapers, radio, TV, but there's no way for the communication to go in two directions. Or there is, you can write a letter to the editor or whatever, but it's nothing compared to the power of, you know, someone on a TV station spreading their ideas. I think it was the legal scholar Stanley Ingber, if I'm not mistaken, who said that, the greatest idea in the world, if it's just spoken in a park somewhere, can't hold a candle to the stupidest, most harmful idea that's spoken into a radio microphone.
Right.
You just have so many more listeners. But when it comes to social media, you have some degree of democratization of the public sphere. At least you expand the public sphere much further than what existed in the kind of legacy media ecosystem. So from, I think from a societal perspective, from a democratic perspective, what these institutions are supposed to be is a place for a much broader public sphere where everyone can debate and offer their own ideas, offer their own criticism of ideas that never before would have been criticized, or at least the criticisms would never have been heard by masses of people, but now they are. So I think that's the kind of ideal, from a democratic perspective, the ideal role for social media in general.
Okay, but if that's the case, then again, looking back at it purely from a First Amendment free speech US perspective, in your opinion, should Twitter be filtering, not necessarily censoring, because they don't do that too often, but should they sort of, you know, like what they did with Trump, should they do that to people's opinion, fake or not?
I can certainly speak for myself.
Right.
There's a lot of different opinions on this, and it kind of goes back to that same philosophy that Judge Learned Hand brought up, that if you have a free marketplace of ideas, that's really the only way that we have to separate truth from falsehood. I agree with that to a large extent, but I think we have to think about how we structure that free marketplace of ideas. Right now, the way that marketplace of ideas is structured in the U.S. in reality is that you have these ideological bubbles where it's very easy to just tune into information that supports your ideology, that doesn't bother you, that doesn't cause you any discomfort, and you can completely separate yourself from contrary ideas and arguments against what you already believe. So I think I still do agree in the ideal of a free marketplace of ideas, but I don't think it just emerges naturally, and certainly not on for-profit social media companies. Because for instance, if you're the CEO of Twitter or Facebook, and you notice that when people are confronted with ideas that go against their political beliefs, they don't like it, they feel bad, and they close your app and go play a video game or watch a video, well, then you think, okay, well, that's a problem. We need to fix that. We need to make sure that everyone is only getting ideas that they already like, because that keeps them on the app. So their profit motivation goes directly against the goal of democracy and having a free marketplace of ideas. For me, the ideal situation would be anyone with a mass audience, basically anything that they say on Facebook or Twitter, nearby for the viewer, there are contrary ideas, so that there's an actual debate being had that everyone can actually see and participate in. And avoid, I think that these companies have to avoid ideological bubbles where you only follow people that agree with you, you never see ideas that discomfort you. That I think is a structural flaw in the current system. But of course, what I'm arguing for is not only something that Donald Trump probably wouldn't like, because it means every time that he tweets something that is factually disconnected from reality, everyone is going to see a criticism of that, so he would be against it. But likewise, the owners of these companies would be against it, because most likely that would drive user participation down somewhat, and that would lower their profitability.
And I think that is essentially, what it all boils down to. Because, Trump can sort of parade his free speech flag all day, all night. But it's like you said, especially on social media, things, and not just social media, the internet in general, things are not as cut and dry. You're dealing with algorithms. You're also dealing with, like you said, people you follow. Everyone, if you're only following people of a similar idea, that's what you're going to be fed over and over and over again. So it's not as cut and dry. And there are also those who argue that Trump's order, the executive order, whether or not it comes to fruition, the order is actually anti-free speech rather than, you know, promoting free speech. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's almost axiomatic that's true. I mean, anytime you open up any sort of media company, it doesn't have to be a social media company, it could be a newspaper, and you say that you're liable for any speech that violates the law or violates someone's rights, then that's going to put a damper on any sort of speech that their lawyers think might open them up to lawsuits. I mean, you see the same thing on YouTube, for instance, with copyright concerns. So we have the fair use exemption, which lays out a number of exceptions where if you're using copyrighted material for, say, an educational purpose, not for a profit-making purpose, you're allowed to do that. However, in practice, you really can't, because practically speaking, the hosting company like YouTube would look at that as a dangerous liability. You might get sued. Even if you win in court, that's besides the point. You'll still have a huge legal bill to successfully defend yourself against such a court case.
Right.
So therefore, you know, I think it's just unarguable that if social media companies were allowed to be sued because they assisted someone in committing an act of defamation, for instance, that just is automatically, assuredly going to be a restriction on speech. I should mention, though, I forgot to bring up before in the discussion of the kind of political establishment reaction to the internet and their view of their own power slipping away, their ability to control the political discourse slipping away, and the idea of fake news being this new threat. Well, of course, fake news has always existed. I mean, you can just go back 20 years and see a whole lot of fake news in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, on CBS, NBC, et cetera, all of the most prestigious media outlets about weapons of mass destruction, about ties of the Saddam Hussein regime to Al-Qaeda. So fake news is something that's always existed, and it's particularly dangerous when the attempt to cut down on fake news is driven by the same people who are responsible for government-sponsored fake news. So they're basically saying, no, the only kind of fake news that we can allow is fake news that's pushed by the government. But if it's fake news pushed by some minor YouTuber with 500 viewers, that's what we need to crack down on.
Well said, well said. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Peter.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Assistant Professor Peter Beatty, a retired lawyer and an academic who's currently teaching at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. His areas of expertise include political psychology, media, and global political economy. And we've been talking about Donald Trump's fight with social media companies and what that means for free speech. If you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or on Spotify. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.